Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. We're live at the library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. Tomorrow we're off. It's Thanksgiving. GBH is airing special Thanksgiving programming. And Friday it's an encore edition of the show, which means sort of a best of. We'll be back live on Monday. We're joined now on Zoom by Corby Kummer. Corby's the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello there, Corby.
Free Thanksgiving. Hello.
Hello, Corby Kummer. Are you all set? Are you cooking, Corby, for Thanksgiving?
Thank goodness, no. My wonderful cousins are cooking in northern Connecticut, where we all grew up.
Oh, okay. Well, it took me 6 hours to get to northern Connecticut a few years ago, so you better
be careful. So I'd leave now. Yep.
Yeah, you better be careful.
Great to hear.
Okay. We spent a lot of time with our listeners at the top of the show talking about something that was in your pile here of stories about moving Thanksgiving to October like Canada does, and lots of people thought that was a good idea. What do you think?
I think it's a fine idea because harvest, because doesn't run into the holidays. There's that great Noel Coward line, once again, the holiday season is at our throats.
Yes, at our throats. I love that.
So this makes it sort of, you know, less horrible and scary. But I knew very much that the tradition of Thanksgiving in November was post-Civil War. It was a woman, Sarah Hale, who was a woman's magazine editor, who said we've got to have some kind of national holiday that brings us together. What I didn't know is that it shifted from the fourth to the third Thursday because of a retailer, Lazarus. The Lazarus company was huge. It became Macy's, who said we don't want this to get in the way of our sales. And it went back and forth between the third and fourth Thursday of November, and now it's at the fourth. So it makes plenty of sense, but, you know, we're so used to it, right?
I know.
It's just getting used to something new, and like, I don't know, in our lifetimes, maybe not. Also football.
That's
right.
Wait
a second. We used to be used to having presidents who believed in democracy. We decided we could change that. So if we could change that, why can't we change this?
Why can't we change daylight savings? Do you remember
saving,
Trump,
my friend,
was elected the first time? That was going to change. There was this stealth bill. And then it got rolled back. Maybe that'll get revived. Let's be optimists.
Okay, fine. We're talking to Corby Kummer. Corby, thanks to you. Well, there are two foods that I used to really like that I do not eat. One because of you and one because of Cy Montgomery. After we talked to her about Sullivan Octopus, I no longer eat octopus, which I'm not looking for a medal, Marjorie. I'm just saying I couldn't do it after she described.
That's heroic of you.
Sentient, is that how you describe?
Sentient,
is that the right word?
Right.
I mean, whatever. And when you described, I can't believe I didn't know this till you described it like 5 years ago, how foie gras is produced.
It's awful.
Which is maybe the most disgusting thing I've ever heard in my life.
Don't describe it.
I'm not going to describe it.
Good.
It is. Should I describe it?
No.
is one of the most disgusting things I've ever heard. I have not touched that, plus it's expensive. So there is now faux, they wouldn't call it faux, but non-foie gras through labs, right? Through lab cultures, right? Am I right about that?
That's three times foie gras has tripped off your tongue with nary a hitch. So
I know.
That's what you've been doing in the 5 years you haven't been eating.
I was really proud of that. Thank you.
The pronunciation. Yeah, this is part of cell cultured meat. So it's an Australian company that has been trying to get a toehold in the market. And what has it done? It has reproduced in vats, because that's how it is. Take a couple of cells of an actual animal that was killed and sacrificed, but it's not a whole bunch of animals. In this case, the animal is a quail. It's not even a duck. It's not even a duck or a goose liver, which are the classic foie gras ingredients in which ducks are force-fed down their gullets in a process that the farmers say they like.
He just described it. Why aren't you yelling at him? I'm serious. He
go
just
go to the farm, and they all really enjoy it. You know, it's the most fun they've had ever. So, and then they're killed, and they have these horribly diseased fatty livers. You like that? So these are quail. There's a couple of cells, and then they mix them with various flavorings, again, into a paste like liverwurst, which is one of Jim's favorites.
It is one of my favorites.
And they spread it on toast, and it mimics the taste of foie gras. What are the advantages? So few animals are killed. In this case, they're quail. But second, it's so commercially impossible to make enough of these, to brew enough of them in a growth medium so that you can make it sellable and you can put it onto the market. That what this Australian company has said is, we're going to go after the most expensive per ounce meat already. We'll try to reproduce the flavor of that. And consumers, with conscience-stricken consumers like Jim and Marjorie,
that's right,
will be able to have an alternative because they were paying through the nose, not the fatty liver anyway, for this delicacy. Now we'll give them a humane alternative that can salve their conscience. Still, so it's a clever idea. We're not going to see it commercialized in our lifetime, but it was a good publicity stunt by this Australian company.
Well, you know what's really interesting that I hadn't thought about, but I'm sure you had, is almost any time there's an attempt to mimic a wonderful tasting food, either a vegan version or this lab created version, the thing most of us do is compare. I've done this with impossible meat and that sort of thing, compared it to the real thing. They make the point in this story that since fewer than 10% of the population have ever tasted foie gras to begin with, no one knows what to compare it to. So if they ever can get the damn thing to market, it's probably going to sell a lot more easily than a, I know they don't like the word faux, but you know what I mean, than a other faux food product would sell. Don't you, you buy that, right?
First of all, it is faux because it's not, it's quail.
Okay,
it's
so faux, okay. Okay.
Second, there's a small percentage of those synthesized, grown out in a lab cells anyway that are going to go into it, which is the way it's been with the chicken products that have come onto the market, like maybe 10%. And as for 10%, I really circled that figure. Fewer than 10% of Americans have heard of or tasted foie gras. I bet it's fewer than 2%.
I bet you're right.
1%. It's the tiniest percentage. So who knows how many people would be curious enough to pay $120 for a piece of toast.
Yeah, and also, didn't they say at the end it tasted kind of like earth and foraged mushrooms? Not, it wasn't very good?
You know, absolutely fine. Foraged mushrooms and earth are things that you would think of if you had real foie gras, which Jim wants to pronounce again.
Yeah.
But you know what the founder of, one of the companies, because there's several companies chasing this market, said to the really terrific food writer, Tim Carman, from the Washington Post, who wrote this piece, when he said, you know, it really doesn't taste like foie gras. And he said, good. We don't want it to. People don't particularly like foie gras once they taste it. So if it tastes like earth and mushrooms, maybe people will like that.
By the way, it's great we spent 10 minutes discussing something Corby said will not be in the market in our lifetimes.
I know.
We'll never have it.
Well,
good.
We have another story by Tim Carman, co-written by Emily Heil, about people. Actually, it starts with a pretty funny story, but people eating their feelings when they were upset about the election. This woman gets up and she talks about how she had been tempted all the time by this Korean fried chicken shop not far from her house. So she was so upset when she woke up the election morning that she raced down there and bought 8 spicy wings and ate 6 of them before she even had a Zoom meeting and topped it all off with a Butterfinger bar before like 9 o'clock in the morning.
You know what? I needed Korean
chicken. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I thought, we all sympathize with you, madam.
That's right. So one person said they were stress eating so much they may hit 270, they meant pounds, but you could say electoral college votes, Jim, before either of the candidates. Oh, that was
a
good line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't, you know, this is, you're making it sound like it's an outlying thing.
No, I think a lot
for
of people
did
this.
For those of us who eat when we're stressed, yep. This is, I mean, it's a, I was going to say a huge thing, but it is a huge.
Isn't it weird? Like some people eat when they're stressed and some people don't eat when they're stressed. There's a real dichotomy there.
But there's actually kind of good news, which is that if it's really stress-provoked and it's episodic and you stop the stress eating when you realize this is the new reality, what am I going to do about it? Let me figure out a way to take action. Your weight will go back to normal. It doesn't reset your equilibrium and your metabolism. So maybe you'll gain a little weight, but you'll go back to eating normally, usually, if it's just one trigger like the election.
I don't think that's true. I mean, excuse me. There was a story in the, we read this morning or yesterday where the average American still weighs 4 pounds more than they weighed last Thanksgiving. And it was the extra weight, 8 or 9 pounds, came from Thanksgiving, and they've only shed half of it in 12 months.
Yeah, but that would go if he's going to say it.
Why is he not answering that?
He's thinking.
I don't believe it, you know, because tracing it to one event, like Thanksgiving seems very unlikely. Also, that people would eat, would gain 8 pounds in one day, that's a real feat. That's almost impossible to do. So I'm going to.
What are you doing tomorrow, Corby? I'll show you how you do that if you want to join me tomorrow. Corby, can we go back to, well, sort of, that is the real world. Stop and Shop, and not Stop and Shop, Shaw's
and Star Market.
And Star Market apparently could be purchased by Kroger. And we're not bringing this up sort of as a business discussion, but in light of the fact that the cost of groceries was such a central theme in this election, there's some people who believe when you reduce competition, when a monster, I don't mean a monster in a disparaging way, I mean in terms of size, like Kroger controls more of the market, prices are going to go up. The flip side is that apparently Star and Shaw's have been having some issues, and this may stabilize prices. Who's right there, Corby Cummer?
I was fascinated by this counterintuitive argument because, of course, I have been agreeing with the Biden administration, which takes the position if there's a monopoly, big mergers only hurt consumers because prices go up and their choice goes down as well as prices going up. But this was saying what we've been hearing about the rise in Boston grocery prices so much steeper than in other parts of the country is that without a big retailer like Walmart or Aldi, the German chain, that can come in with much lower prices and really get a huge foothold, not just toehold in a local market, a fragmented bunch of small markets have no real incentive to lower prices because no monster is coming in with really price-beating competition. And this says that if Albertsons and Kroger's, meaning that Shaw's and Star Market, join forces, their combined power can mean that this big national behemoth can have lower prices because they've got more buying power and they can pass those on inside the actually few number of stores they have relative to other cities in Boston, and maybe the other local markets like Market Basket will have to lower prices to meet them. It sort of seemed tenuous to me as an argument, but it was new and interesting. Also, it said that Albertsons might be on its last legs without much of a future, and the Kroger's could be its last hope.
You know, since you mentioned Walmart in passing, let me just say something we weren't going to talk about today, but it bears mentioning. Walmart is yet the latest huge corporation that has dropped any pretense of caring about diversity. They've just ended their DEI programs, sort of part of the term that we've adopted here, this anticipatory obedience thing.
Yeah.
And the reason I mention it at all is Walmart is one of the companies which we were surprised embraced DEI post the murder of George Floyd, and we mentioned them on the show. So I think when they abandon this alleged principal position, it bears some mentioning.
The Times has a piece in the business section today about how they're a bellwether and that this guy who targets wokeness in big companies says, yeah, okay, the country voted against wokeness, and my next targets are Target Company and Amazon.
By the way, let me just, in light of the discussion you and Marjorie just had about a stress eating after the election, here's a listener from Mattapan, anonymous. I usually eat fairly healthy, but after the election, horrible. The other day I went to McDonald's, got two chicken sandwiches, two large fries for my husband and me. I ordered a third fry order, wolfed it down on the drive home. I didn't do this in 2016.
Oh, God.
But this time it is awful. So there
you
go.
Yeah, well, I think that person shares the sentiment of a lot of us. Anyway, so let's talk about this drink that tastes a little like sucking dandelion juice through a straw that's made out of car tires, and people are excited about it. What am I?
It's not made out of car tires. It's made out of wormwood. And wormwood, this really caught my eye, because wormwood has a kind of psychedelic ingredient that could induce psychosis, and it was the main ingredient in absinthe. And for a long time, it was outlawed in the U.S. And I think wormwood now, and I didn't look this up, can be used in absinthe, and they treat it so its psychoactive ingredient is, if not neutralized, it's reduced. So this is a bitter drink made with neutral spirits, wormwood, and sugar no car tires, Marjorie. And it was popular in Chicago. And it was a signature drink that was always like a fraternity or a hazing ritual. If you could down a shot of this foul-tasting, bitter stuff, which legendarily, I don't really believe this, was legal in Prohibition because no one could believe it was anything but medicinal. Nobody would ever voluntarily drink it. So if you could have this, or originated in Sweden, you passed the test and you could drink, and it was this rite of Chicago passage. And now it's spreading around the country. There's a whole dedicated bar in New Orleans and Seattle, kind of hipster strongholds.
How do you pronounce it?
I don't know. Malort, I suppose. It's M-A-L-O with an umlaut, which
umlaut.
Doesn't mean
much. I love umlauts.
So I get this, sort of, but I guess I don't know why you want to drink something that tastes so bad.
Some people like the taste of tires, Marjorie. I mean, that's
well,
fairly evident.
The straw, supposedly, tasted like it was made of car tires, not the actual drink itself.
What's wrong with that? So if you think of the huge vogue for Amari, which are bitter digestive liqueurs, at first they taste kind of awful, but generally they have sugar syrup. So does Malort. It's got sugar in it, and it makes it you sort of go back for more. This idea of bitter and bittersweet. I find it interesting and tempting, and I love Amari.
Okay.
I find it interesting and tempting, actually, also. Before you go, there's a wonderful story. I can't remember where we read it.
The cast iron skillets.
Yeah, where's that from?
It's from the Washington Post. Oh. Talking about restoring these cast iron skillets. This is kind of cool. Tell us about
You tell us about it, can I just say, I lived about 90% of my life never having owned or used a cast iron skillet, whatever the hell you call it.
Life-changing, Jim.
It is life-changing.
Otherworldly.
No, I know you're making fun of me. It is life-changing. It changes everything. The cooking, the taste, the crispness, the whatever. So that's why I was fascinated by this restoration story, because occasionally people don't use them for a while, don't season them, they get rusty, you don't know what to do. And this small business apparently restores them.
And they're very heavy.
Go ahead, Corby. Say something.
So for $40, they will make any cast iron pot or Dutch oven seem like new. They can't do enameled stuff. They can't repair enamel. But if it's just plain cast iron, you can send it in. And they get things that have been buried in the woods for 40 years. But I love this story, and it's truly heartwarming because so many of your grandmothers and your mother's utensils were, for example, made of aluminum or stainless steel that rusted, and it's really hard ever to get them back, and they probably weren't all that good in the first place. But cast iron is forever. It really lasts, and this company just charges a straight $40 plus shipping. And I think it's just fantastic. It's called Smithy Ironware, and there are really atmospheric pictures of old-fashioned craftspeople wearing overalls, and they look like they have a wood fire in the background, maybe a cast iron pot over it. And I was tempted to go dig out some old cast iron
because
I always left them to rust.
Can I tell you
why it's so great to have cast iron?
I don't know enough to know.
Corby knows.
Well, you explain it, but then I want to tell a corollary story quickly. Go ahead.
It holds the heat. It's very thick, so there's a lot of heat that it holds. It transfers it very evenly and efficiently, and depending on how high you heat it, it will make something really crisp without burning it. And you can use very little fat because there's fat in it that you usually season it by coating it with oil lightly, leaving it in an extremely low oven overnight. You sometimes do that for 2 and 3 nights. And therefore, it creates a naturally non-stick surface. But it's the thickness of it and the way it holds and transfers heat.
Okay, so I only have a minute. I'm going to tell a quick story about a film.
You're not supposed to put soap in them, right?
No, you don't.
Yeah, you're not
you
supposed
don't.
To.
You scrub
Never
them,
soap.
And then you season them with oil.
Yeah.
Let me just say, this reminds me, this story of this guy in the small business repairing these cast iron reminds me of a movie I've mentioned once more on the show that I happened to watch this weekend. So I want to say, The Last Repair Shop won, the Oscar for the best short documentary. It is this beautiful little story about, I think it is 3 men and women who repair instruments for the Los Angeles school system. And it profiles each of them doing their beautiful fully intentional, committed work. One, I think, does wind instruments. One may do string. I don't know what the hell they are, but it's called Last Repair Shop. It's in the same spirit as this guy who's fixing the cast iron stuff, and you should check it out. It is a beautiful, beautiful little movie.
There was a beautifully written article in The Atlantic that I got to edit by Ian Frazier, one of the country's most gifted writers, about the last typewriter repairman in New York. Tytel, T-Y-T-E-L-L, typewriters. And it's worth looking up in The Atlantic just for a beautifully written, heartwarming story.
We'll do that. Hey, Corby, happy Thanksgiving. It's great to see you.
To you.
Thank you very much, Corby. We've been speaking with Corby Cummer, Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor of The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Thank you so much.